Jeff Bear's Real Talk.
And at the callow youth of 19, I decided then that my father was quite right. I wasn't the man he was or the man my uncles were. I wasn't going to win a VC. I thought, this looks bloody horrible. But having said that, it was quite a minor barrage, as it subsequently turned out. Well, then there was no question of being immediately tank-proof then, as we haven't got any tanks left. They were gradually getting re-equipped. And I'm giving you a little bit of a history of what happened to me. And then Rommel attacked at the end of August, made his attack around the southern tip of the Alamein Line, as such it was called. That meant he went south of the Wyset Ridge. And I was taken out and dumped on a cross track at the corner of by the corner of the New Zealand box, and said, look, you've just got to fight as if you hang on as long as you can here. If you see any Germans, engage them. That's where I stayed about for a week, with the sound of the Germans getting nearer and nearer, and almost continual on this track. I suppose they thought this was a useful kind of track, and under almost continual dive bombing and strafing as the New Zealanders. And I learned a great lesson from the New Zealanders, because the New Zealanders had a marvellous idea. I was always surprised that the British Army didn't take it up. That if they were low-level strafed or low-level dive bombed, it didn't matter what you had in your hand, point it in the sky and pull the trigger. And this was remarkably effective. That meant that every day, whatever they came into, they had to fly into a hail of shot from anything from very light pistols to 45 autumn revolvers. It was a marvellous idea. It did force the planes up. And so I all did that for the rest of my period, not to try and aim at them or shoot at them, although I did do once. That was a marvellous effort.
Where was this New Zealand box?
How can I put it? Two-thirds the way down the Alamein Line going south. They were good soldiers, particularly the Maoris. What I didn't realise, of course, at the time, that my cousin who was fighting with them was getting an MC at the same time. He trod on a mine, and it didn't kill him, but it broke his glasses. But he was in an anti-tank gun. I mean, he'd only engaged the German tanks, I think knocked out three German tanks when he was half blind because his glasses were broken, and he got an MC for that with the Waverley Horse, New Zealand Regiment. But I didn't know that at the time. There we are, we went on, and then we started, then I was appointed to one of the, a driver to a very good officer, Major Boyd Gibbons, I think is probably a build. I'd like to see him again, but I never did after the Battle of Alamein. But he was when he was a major in command of the squadron, I knew exactly what we were doing, why we were doing it. However, he lost command of the squadron to take over another squadron, and then got another squadron leader who I didn't like very much. Then we become this silly thing of the Battle of Alamein. Most impressive. Repeatedly after the war, or during the war, we were told it's going to be a bigger barrage than Alamein. The Alamein barrage was something out of this world, as I'm sure you've been told scores of times. But the Germans weren't helpless. And we were supporting the Australians, the 46th Tank Regiment. And the only reason I'm alive is because odd things happen where you're left out of battle. And there am I, all lined up, ready to attack. We were bracketed by heavy German artillery, and they were giving us some plaster for hours on end. and we were told we were not to move. And so that's where we stayed. And I thought, well, this is only a question of time before one of these big boys is going to blow us to hell. And then the terrific bang, and that's all I could remember until I heard a chap groaning like hell. And I thought, well, who's that chap groaning? And then I heard a voice on the outside amongst all the shellfire. And they said, Jeff, are you all right? And I thought, come, yes, it's me groaning. So I said, yes, and I turned over to get up. And then I went, because I'd got bits of metal gone in my back and they were red hot from the what happened, set my shirt on fire. But I then tried to get out and couldn't. But this chap who'd been my real buddy, Sid Harden, he'd sat on top of the turret amongst all the shot and shell with a crowbar, and I heaved from the bottom, and we got a hatch open so we get out, and so could the other chap who was in the turret. But of course, there was no tank left. The whole tank was blown to smithereens. How we ever survived, I'll never know. I think the engine covers, I think somebody told me they weighed over 200 weight each, and one of them had gone 150 yards. There was nothing left of the tank. The turret was lifted off its seating, and there was nothing left, literally nothing left of the tank behind the turret. However, to carry on with the story, I went along and saw the MO, and the MO said, are you going to go to casualty clearing station, or do you want to get these pieces out yourself? And so I said, well, you might as well get them out yourself. So he said, face down. So face down, he got all these little bits out of my back. Or I thought he had, which he hadn't, as it turned out about 5 years ago, the last piece came out. But he got them all out. And then the squad leader said, well, he'd take over another tank, but he would take over his own operator, and because he was the best wireless operator in the squadron. And they went into the attack that night, and they were absolutely massacred. All that crew were killed, and because I was left out of battle, the CO said, look, I know you've been blasted. He said, there's a job I want you to do. You can drive a tank, can't you? I said, yes, I can drive a tank. And so he said, well, there's a tank in no man's land. We think we can recover. And I'm sending a sapper engineer will go with you, and a couple of engineers, if you'll drive it out, if they can get it mobile. So off we went into the middle of, picked us up in a truck and left us at the end of a track, mixed all up with the Australian. And the engineers repaired this tank and called for me for assistance when it was something heavy to lift or something like this. And we got the tank going, and then they said, well, we better not move it now. We think some Australians came in saying, you know, you're in the middle of a minefield. We didn't know we were in the middle of a minefield. So we said, we'd better wait until light and see what we're doing. So as soon as first light came, we found we were in the middle of a minefield. So I and these two engineers then cleared a path for me to back up, absolutely in the old track marks. We cleared a path through the minefield, prodding for them with bayonets, which was a normal practice, because in those days there weren't many mine locating units, and we finally got the tank out. We didn't realise we were under observation by the Germans at the same time, because one of the Australian officers promptly got sniped and hit in the stomach as he was walking to talk across to us. So after that, expedited our efforts to clear the minefield. And when I got back then to the regiment, expecting to find at least something, you know, half the squadron left, it had just been gone completely. They'd been virtually wiped out with the attack the night before. They had no tanks, nothing. They made up a squadron out of the battalion and lent it to make up the 50th Tank Regiment. And the rest of us went across to get tanks that had been recovered. And the CO, who was a first class chap, a chap named Colonel Offord, he was a man who was a fierce little devil. We used to call him the Black Bastard, but I liked him immensely. And he called me up and said, "Look, Bayes, I've been watching you, I'm pleased with you. You are now a tank commander. Go and get a tank." So that I became a tank commander overnight. He said a few more complimentary things, but we're not interested in that. So I went and collected a tank with a makeshift crew. And the makeshift crew, all that tank didn't smell. We did everything to get rid of it. And we found in the end, I saw the MO, I said, there must be bits and pieces in this tank that we can't find. In the end, we found a finger. We scratched the bloke's brains off the driving seat, and we found a finger still underneath the turret, but that was all that had been left of the bloke concerned that had been in it. But it was highly odoriferous, and in the hot sun, you can imagine what it smelt like. Then, while we did our training as a makeshift crew, and I was a makeshift tank commander, we trundled across the desert hoping we were going to catch up with something. But by this time, they said no, they were going to withdraw us and re-equip us with Shermans. And so then, by which time, I'd had a battle scratch in my hand, and I was absolutely in agony because I had an enormous abscess. I've still got the marks of where it finally went. I'd been to the MO three times, and each time he'd taken his scalpel and just lanced it, having squirted it with ether to make it. But in the end, it blew up to the size of a football, and the next time I saw it, it was all black and rotten. And he said, "Right, hospital, I'm pulling you out." So I went to hospital then to have this battle scratch. That's all it was, a battle scratch. But I had a hand, certainly, absolute agony. And he put me out before they even went into the ambulance with it. And so off I went to the hospital in Heliopolis in Cairo. And the regiment went to just south of there, to Mena, to re-equip the Shermans. So, re-equipped with Shermans, we were. But then another crisis came up. These crises happen all the time in life. And some German destroyers had been sunk by some Italian destroyers and a German submarine had been sunk in the Red Sea by the Navy and the RAF. And their crews had been interned by the Saudi Arabians. So the powers that be, or who we've got we can send down there, and join a ship and pick them up. And they obviously did a political deal that they were going to swap them for British naval personnel in Italian hands. So we were hastily kitted out in civilian clothes and joined the Talma. Sailed down to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia.
What was the Talma?
The Talma was the name of this freighter, which was going to convey these Italian I can't call them POWs, because Saudi Arabia was neutral, internees, to Turkey, to Mersin. The journey was eventful, because there were about 30 of us there, and there were several hundred Italian below deck. And there were also six deserters from Syria who joined the Telma unknown to us, and they were inciting the six British deserters, inciting the Italians to mutiny and saying, look, you can run the ship, we'll help you get arms. In the end, we caught them and strung them up in the mess and called for the Italian senior officer to see them and said, well, look, you're going to be strung up like this. If there's any more trouble from you on this, or these are the six English deserters, you see how we treat our own deserters.
Strung them up?
Yes, roped up, strung them up from the mess. And
you mean tied up?
Yes. And then when we got to Suez, we radioed, got back to Suez, and we didn't have any more trouble from the Italians. The Italian commandant took one of these, like these blokes, who we'd hauled his arms up behind his back, so he was just on his toes, and he thought, this is a rum set up, I don't want any more part with this. So when we got to Suez, we got the... the military police came out to pick these chaps up, and the Italians were still watching out of their portholes, and we didn't wait for them to go down the gangplank to the launch. We just kicked them straight over the side down the side as they fell in the launch, and then we set sail, went through the canal, set sail for Turkey. On the way there, although the Telma was scrawled all the way along the side, and everybody was supposed to give us free passage with these several hundred Italians aboard, a Savoy Machetti came over and circled us very carefully. All the guns were sheeted up. I was standing on the foresail, and it circled round again, and I thought, surely that bastard's not going to bomb us. And he came over exceedingly low, and the Italians on the deck, taking their exercise, all waved and what have you. And then, from a height of about a couple of hundred feet, he promptly proceeded to bomb us. He couldn't even hit us. But the Italians, I thought, what rubbish you are. They're absolutely panic-stricken. And after all, they were naval personnel. They should have, you know what, a German officer, one of the U-boat officers there, was standing there with them. And he looked at me, I shall never forget his face, he looked at me, and I looked at him, and we were watching this Savoy Machetti coming round to bomb us again, he just spread his hands in a gesture of complete, he said, that's what we're lumbered with. And I just laughed, and he laughed, and we just watched this Savoy Machetti come round again and miss us yet again. And then it flew off. So then we went to Turkey, and we picked up the British POWs. The Turkish gendarmerie there just laughed at us. All our passports were students. They were heavily tanned. Some of us with shoulder holsters and what have you, and all this ill-fitting civilian clothes. They were all very amused. It was all very sort of a bit of a giggle. But then we picked up the naval personnel, and whereas the Italian personnel that we'd handed over were all in first class lip, apart from having a yellow band down their spine, these chaps were in a terrible state. I think six of them died on the way back to, and one of them I was sitting with him when he was getting very sort of poorly, and he said, the Germans always treated us well, and the German POW camps, they always treated us properly. But the Italians, he said, they treated us very badly. And he said, when you eventually meet the Italians, he said, always be more hard on the Italians than you are on the Germans. which was absolutely true. So then we returned to Egypt, finished our training with Sherman's, and headed off on the big trail up to Tunis, by which time Tunis had fallen.
So this is obviously about the spring of 1943.
Yes. So then we did intensive training for the invasion of Italy, and for the invasion of Sicily. One squadron was attached to the 50th Battalion, B Squadron, to do the initial landing, and I and the rest of them went in the second wave. They went up to Jabini, and that squadron, to all intents and purposes, you can say that squadron was completely wiped out. They were fighting against the German parachute regiment and the Hermann Göring division, and they were really first class troops. But on my side, I went up more towards Etna.
Which squadron were you in?
I was in A squadron. We went up more towards Etna. While I was going up there, I also they said, well, we'll do a major reconnaissance in force and push up that valley there. Well, the squadron leader, the troop leader was leading, and there was an explosion of his tank. He said, well, come along and help. So I said, we would come alongside and help, and we came alongside him, and then we went up as well. And I realised he hadn't been hit by an anti-tank gun, but we were in the middle of a minefield again. So I got ordered my own gunner out, and we manned the machine gun up in some rocks up in the hillside. And eventually another tank was ordered up to try and tow us out. The troop leader was absolutely clocked, because I told my crew to get back inside a tank, and one of them did, the gunner and operator did, and he got him back inside the tank with me, and the troop leader said, there's no need to get back in there, then we get on this there quickly and get out of the way. And of course, he was an absolute twit, because the first thing that happened, as they tried to tow it out, another mine went up and wrote off the remnants of my crew. So I was left with just the gunner and myself, and the crew all spread around. The nicest one of the lot, I think his eyes were blown out. I bandaged his eyes up. But telling me he just got dirt in them and what have you, but I couldn't see anything there at all. The chap that I'd wanted to get killed, who had unfortunately all he did was got shell shock. And I was sorry that he hadn't got killed. He'd been a chap that I thought he'd wanted killing ages ago.
What was wrong with him?
He got a yellow streak down his back. All he got, and he always had, he always resisted any orders to advance as much as he could without insubordination. And I hadn't got much time for him. But the chap that lost his eyes was a nice little chap, a genuine little chap. In my diary, I said, I'm sorry that yellow so-and-so is still alive, but he didn't come to any real damage. But the other one, we all sort of got bits and pieces in him. He wasn't seriously injured. But my gunner and I were all right. Anyway, so off they toddled with this tank. This is all you can go on like this indefinitely. Tell me when to shut up, Mr. Wood.
Please give as much detail as you can.
And then they decided to put an infantry probe in. So the infantry came up quite happily. This is why I meant it was absolute lack of... We were very amateurish all the way until 1944. We were a lot of babes in arms. The infantry probe came in, I suppose, platoons, about 30 men, sweeping up this valley. And I said, what the hell do you think you're doing? And they said, well, we're going to sweep up this valley. I said, you're sweeping straight up of a minefield. I said, three tanks gone up already. And they said, oh, hell. And I said, and furthermore, there are two tanks up there, and I don't know whether they're ours or theirs. And I said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll get back in the... I'll tell my gunner to get back in the turret, and we'll give you covering fire in case there are enemy tanks. So they went on their way, treading very gingerly, and we got there to cover them in case they were German tanks and not British tanks. And... So then, eventually my tank was pulled out and repaired, went forward a little bit, didn't meet the enemy. He withdrew across the Messina Straits, and we sat down then to wait to attack Italy, which is, I think, to my memory, was about September time. And then we did promptly went across to Taranto. Now, while all this is going on, my friend Hardman, who had been wounded very badly, where he, in effect, I told you, he's at the woods at Jabini, they were virtually wiped out. And he'd been wounded as well. Now, Potsy used to go around the hospitals and recruit wounded recoupees because he liked people who had been shot at. And as we crossed the Messina Straits and landed at Taranto, a whole lot of odd bods turned up in the middle of the night and said, we're PPA, Special Forces, and we've got authority to have you all your 0.5 brand new machine guns. It's a bit of a silly idea, really. The Americans mounted a 0.5 Browning on the top of the turret. If you'd ever wanted to operate one, you'd have had to sit on the top of the turret to do it, and so they were virtually... Nobody ever used them. So... we gave the one of the people there was Sid Hardman, and he said, come and join us, Jeff, this is a better war altogether. And so I said, right, I will. He said, Rickwood, who had been my old squadron leader in the 46th Tank Regiment before the first Battle of Alamein, he said, he's there as adjutant. He'd also been wounded, he's there as adjutant. So put in your application. And, hey presto. Well, I put the application in, the colonel just sent for me and said, you can get lost, I'm not processing this. You're young now, you're young, you're an experienced tank commander, and I'm not letting anybody, you don't stand a cat in hell's chance. Then there was another one.